This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter and producer at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a weekly series of coronavirus conversations, presented jointly with a forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you here in The World's podcast feed. This week, we spoke with Nancy Krieger, professor of social epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, about the coronavirus pandemic and unequal risks for communities of color. So now to begin, Nancy, you've looked really closely at COVID-19 and the way that it's taking a disproportionate toll on people of color, also people living in poverty. What have you observed? What have you found so far, just to kick things off?
So I think there's actually two parts to your question. The first is you have to have data in order to see anything. And the very first part of my work involved in COVID-19 was actually saying, where are the data? That in the initial early days of the pandemic, the data were not being reported at all by race, ethnicity, by the CDC, or anybody else. And some of the very first writings that I was doing was not only that it was not being reported by race, ethnicity, it was not being reported with any socioeconomic data whatsoever. So there was no way to look at who was being impacted. And when you start thinking about COVID-19 and you think about its roots of spread, and you think about that, pretty quickly it got realized that there's going to be community transmission as opposed to it coming in through international connections of predominantly people who can afford to fly, that it's going to get nested in places through adverse conditions at work under quote-unquote essential workers, and then also people that are living in crowded households. And the data weren't there to speak to that. So my first work was actually raising concerns about the lack of data. I do a lot of work before coming into this with cancer registry data, with vital statistics, with all kinds of public health surveillance systems. And it is completely 100% normal to have data on simultaneously race, ethnicity, age, sex, gender, minimally, and also usually information on where people live, their residential address, which you can geocode to link to area characteristics. And for COVID, that wasn't happening. And the question still remains why. And there are various hypotheses, but be that as it may, what that led to was the first work that I did to try to figure out, well, what is going on with the social realities of COVID-19 and who is being excessively burdened by this pandemic? I mean, in the sense, many people will be affected, but the issue is not only that many people will be affected, but that the effects will be inequitable. For them to be inequitable, that means that they're unjust and unfair in that sense, that they're avoidable and above all preventable, at least in principle, and that prevention is not happening. So the first studies we did were the very first ones actually to take the COVID data that were being produced at the county level for the cases, even with all the inadequate testing, and also the mortality data, even with the delays in mortality reports, and say, how does that vary by county level of poverty, of percent people of color, of percent of people who live in crowded housing? And note that the definition of crowding really is crowding. The way that the U.S. Census defines crowding is more than one person per room, not counting bathrooms. So for example, if you have somebody living in an apartment that has a kitchen, a bedroom, and a dining room, that's crowded only if there are four or more people in it, which is pretty crowded.
Yeah. So,
yes, that's the definition. There are others that are out there in the literature. And so we were able to look at that, plus a measure we've developed of racialized economic segregation, which looks at the extent to which the population in an area is either concentrated in being, for example, white affluent families versus low-income, either African-American, Black, or populations of color. And we could show that the cases and the mortality rates for counties both went up dramatically with worse conditions in those counties. What we then did was that led to the next study to say, well, we know that there are problems with, for example, the testing for COVID, and that's used partly for determining who gets counted as dying COVID-19. But people are dying not only of COVID-19, with that unreported. Some of the people that are dying, for example, at home, not going to the hospital, has been occurring in some communities. But also there are other kinds of mortality that can be related, the concerns about delays in seeking care, for example, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a different approach that some people have taken, which is to look at what is the total number of deaths happening in, say, this 1 week or 2 week period, compared to what would normally would be expected for the 5 years beforehand for that same 2 week period. And you want to think about it in time that way, because you have seasonality to other diseases. There's the flu, there's other things that happen. There can be more car accidents at certain times of the year, et cetera, et cetera. So what we did is we compared the 2020 mortality data for Massachusetts by zip code and also by city town to the 2015 to 2019 data. And we did that actually in collaboration in part with the Boston Globe. And we could again link to those same kind of social metrics about poverty, about how crowded households, about proportion of population by people of color and also Black, and also the racialized economic segregation. And we show that the surge was much greater in the worse off communities. And that was actually revealed new information, because although we did, for example, pick up what was happening here in Massachusetts, that was well known for Chelsea, we also picked up what was going on, for example, in Lawrence, that hadn't gotten the same kind of attention by virtue of doing this kind of analysis. Well, that led to the next question. There's a lot being said in the literature or purporting to say that, well, the higher mortality must all be due to chronic diseases. Well, that cannot be the full explanation. And part of that is, then we looked at, and we have, this is work with another colleague, of looking at the age-specific rates of mortality. And those data have only recently become available, stratified by race, ethnicity. And again, this is really basic data. It is completely abnormal and absurd that these data have not been available before. But what they are showing is that the racial ethnic excesses in mortality, which are presented usually as overall age standardized excesses of 2 to 3 fold, for example, are way higher among younger people of working age. If you look at 25 to 44, 45 to 64. And that's, we were seeing some rates in that 35 to 64 that are in the order of 7 to 9 times higher, comparing, for example, Black to white non-Hispanic. And these are outrageous rates. And this is driven by transmission. And that transmission is driven by, predominantly, we hypothesize, and the data are becoming evident that support this hypothesis, to what's happening with people's exposure being essential workers at work, and then also bringing it back home to more crowded housing where there's not a possibility for isolation. I'd like also to quickly emphasize that crowded housing is not the same as population density. Some people get these confused. Mm. You have very rich areas that have very densely populated apartments that are not remotely crowded as apartments. People are not living under crowded household conditions. So there's not the same thing. And that is really important, which, because it speaks to the key problems then of what's going on with lack of access to affordable housing and to a living wage, and to the possibilities of having workplace policies that do or don't allow you to get sick leave when you need it.
So it sounds like, because that was one of my initial questions, just about how do you entangle some of these different factors that show these really stark disparities and inequities. And it sounds like for you, what you're seeing is housing as being a big factor in there, or how you
work
move that research forward.
Work is fundamental, because if you're not exposed, you don't get sick. This is a very basic idea. And it's not only about personal protective equipment, although that is part of it. And there's a lot of emphasis on PPE, as there ought be for healthcare workers. But what's been going on for all the other essential people? Actually, a huge proportion of the U.S. population works in jobs that have to be at their workplace. They're not the people that are capable of being able to stay home and do their work. And so that's not what the work permits. And so there's a question of A, how you get back and forth to work and what the exposures are, and B, what happens at work. And it's notable that OSHA thus far has been completely lax in anything with regard to taking care of occupational health. There's been one citation in this whole time. There's a database of open and closed complaints for OSHA that's now online that our team is also looking at, that currently has over 14,000 complaints in it. There has been only one citation.
Is what you're finding surprises you in terms of, as you, with frustration, and I've made a note because we are getting a lot of online questions about this question of data, so I want to get to that soon, but I'm curious, has what you're finding about these inequities, about the essential workers and these differences so stark and disturbing. Like, has that surprised you going in based on what you had suspected? And what does that tell you about society and also about this pandemic?
So in one sense, it doesn't surprise me. At the same time, every new disease has its surprises. And both are true. This is called science. You learn new things. You can't just always work off of old assumptions. It's a good bet that when a new disease hits, there will be inequities. You have to see how they're going to manifest. And it's important to be aware they can manifest in different processes. What is happening with risk of exposure? What is happening given that your exposure to likelihood of getting sick? What is happening given likelihood that giving you sick, likelihood of dying? And there are three different junctures in the process of what's going on with the disease. So the specifics are not surprising about the fact that there are inequities in each step. But as I've said before, I feel that COVID-19 has pulled the thread at a time when also there is much else that is going on in our society in terms of the pulling of the threads and the revealings of the horrific conditions around police brutality and disproportionately killing people of color in this country, about what the politics are of structural racism that are being called out. COVID-19 has cast a very harsh light in that. At the same time, when you've got the ACA under threats, when you had public health so defunded for so many years, with public health being eviscerated, when you have an administration that is absolutely hell-bent on deregulating anything that is a public health protection around environment and workplace. And all these things have come together, crashing in on COVID-19 at the same time, which at the same time is raising these profound questions about what's the point of government anyway, if it's not to protect the people's health.
Hmm. So are you seeing any policies now? This is a comes from an online question. Are you seeing policies being proposed to address these sorts of things? Action from local, state, or federal leaders that can protect these populations? Or what would that action look like?
I mean, there are different things that are going on. So first, I want to just, again, tease that into different parts. First, on the data side, some of the CARE Act has said that, for example, it mandates that as of August 1, lab tests must include data on race, ethnicity, as well as zip code and other things. How that's going to actually be implemented and reported remains to be seen. But the fact that this would have, I just want to flag that the very first CDC report forms for COVID-19 testing did have things that people could fill in for race, ethnicity, did have a zip code, did have sex, gender, age, whatever. These were like standard, they're standard items that you include. They're not like mystery items that are very strange to ask about, but they weren't being filled out. They're still not being filled out. So this is now saying you have to do it and that there are consequences financial if you don't. So we'll see if that, you know, carrot stick has a different approach now in getting the data. But yes, I mean, if you look at some of the legislation that's being passed in different places, whether it's about here, I mean, I can just speak to the Massachusetts data, in part the controversies about the protections around evictions and rent, the questions about extension of sick pay leave, and then also calls. I mean, there are mainly calls for more action by OSHA, but also that's not happening at the federal level.
So, what kind of OSHA actions
there are policies being there are policies being proposed. There's a question of what will be enacted.
What would you see for like an OSHA example? Because I'm still thinking about what you
what's
said
being
earlier.
Called for right now is actually setting a regulatory standard with regard to specifically that this is an occupational threat. So there is it. So that what's being appealed. I'm talking to my occupational health colleagues, and you should follow up with people who have more expertise in that than I am. Being advised by them, is that there's a general standard that many people are appealing to, but there also is some language that's about infectious disease at work. Because again, what's happening here is that this is not the same as, for example, having a guard on a saw, in the sense that that actually has to be at work. It is built into the process of doing the work itself, or having a toxic chemical at work. This is about the fact that you do work with other people. Work is always a social as well as physical thing. And this is really key to understand. And the social interactions, I've done plenty of other research looking at questions of how, for example, racial discrimination and sexual harassment at work are not good for your blood pressure, among many other things. Work involves interactions with people as well as with the biophysical world in which you're actually doing the work. And we as human beings are simultaneously and always social beings and biological organisms. We are engaged in our society, in our ecology. This is the essence of who we are, like any living organism. And we are always constantly embodying our context. And that context is societal and ecological. And we live as basically emergent embodied phenotypes. There's no other way to be alive except that. And that's what we see reflected in this pandemic, as we do with many other diseases. And so with work, it's important to understand that that work involves the social policies about who can be at work, who is not at work, what the leave is at work, as well as the biophysical conditions in which people work, as well as the social rules about how they work with each other.
So I want to remind people that this is a Facebook Live where you can add in and post your questions for myself and Nancy Krieger. I want to actually just pivot a little bit to what you talked about with data and absurdity earlier, but in elaborating, you were talking about how some of the testing data, people weren't filling out the race information, even though it's there. But there's this question, it comes from online, about the Trump administration ordering hospitals to send COVID-19 patient information to a central database at the Department of Health and Human Services instead of to the CDC. Then the CDC shut down its coronavirus dashboards for about a day, then it came back online under pressure. So what do you make of the back and forth over how data is reported and shared? I want to just start with that and what the implications are for data or lack thereof. Because as a researcher, I can see that being really important, but what is the implication from there as well?
So data don't simply exist, and data are never a given. People produce data. They obtain information about the world. They manipulate it in a way that can be meaningful and then shared with others. And the data in public health are always meant to be actionable. They're not just curiosities. And the data also, because they are about what I would call embodied truths, they actually point to liability. And it's no surprise that you have, for example, a lot of the contestation around many of the public health regulations is because if there are people that are benefiting from potentially harming others by what their actions and policies are, what their exposures are to chemicals or to other kinds of low wages or to whatever the different insults are, they don't like seeing the data there. And so this has been an ongoing tension. I mean, years ago, early days when I was just cutting my teeth in public health and the AIDS epidemic and much else, and there was an attempt also in California to suppress any racial ethnic data being collected by the state under the idea that the conservative was argument that it was, quote unquote, not a real category, therefore data should not be conducted. What it missed and what the whole point was is, of course, it wanted to avoid any possibilities of having data to show statistically that discrimination exists or that there's differential harm by race ethnicity. So a key part to understand about racial ethnic data in the U.S. is that it is a category that was born out of oppressive relations of both enslavement and colonialism. However, it's been moved because of social movements, particularly in the 1960s, to become a category by which you can understand inequity and by which you can demonstrate harm and you can advocate against it. So it's not just a fixed thing. It's meaning, how it's imbued, how it's looked at, how it's analyzed, how it's acted on, absolutely depends on the social ideas and contests and controversies of the time. So from that standpoint, it's no surprise, as I said way back then, the standard approach has been no data, no problem. If you can get rid of the data, you don't have a problem because people can't make a fuss about it. Which is why always public health has very much been usually on the side of as much data with as much transparency as possible. It's not surprising, for example, that if you look again, this is my world of cancer registries, that in many states you can easily get access to, if you're a researcher, to the cancer registry data, if you go through the appropriate submission policies, et cetera, et cetera. But some states that have notable problems of particular kinds, like Louisiana, it's just not possible.
Hmm. So how do you bring that?
That's very tied to the petrochemical industry there. So the no data, no problem is a long ruse. It's a long-standing approach to try to make a problem go away. And especially if you don't want data to get out, that you are conscious that there are communities that will organize it around it and make the fuss for change for equity, that's another good reason to suppress the data. And if anyone thinks that getting rid of the data now on COVID-19 is going to somehow conceal that people are dying, that hospitals are crashing out in Texas, that's not going to happen. That's reality.
So how do you get data when it's not as quickly available? What are some ways you've done that? This comes from online. And I kind of extend that too to think about parallels with, for example, in Brazil, similarly, there's been some barriers put up to accessing just general data on COVID-19 there, testing.
So I'll make two parallels. So one is what we have done in the work on COVID itself is building on longstanding work I've done with the Public Health Disparities Geocoding Project, which I got into because there was no socioeconomic data in most US health statistics. So how do you get around that if it's not going to even be in the records, if it's not in the hospital records, if it's not in the cancer statistics, if it's not in the whatever? And what you can say is that usually there's an address. And the reason there's usually an address is people are getting billed. And so given that you can find out where people live, you can then link to the attributes of the, like the census tract in which they live or other kinds of geographic areas. And so we did a lot of work to validate that across a ton of different kinds of health outcomes, from birth to death, from lead poisoning to infant mortality to all kinds of mortality, et cetera, et cetera. So brought that same expertise to the COVID situation, which is how we know that we could link the COVID data to the zip codes where people live, the census tracts, which we're doing right now, to where people live, et cetera. So that's one way, which is to say, it might not be in the health record itself what you want, but you could quickly link these other kinds of data. That's how we could report so early on about what was going on in counties in relation to proportion of population that were people of color, for example, or that were impoverished, because we could make those kinds of data linkages and we know how to do that. So one part is to say you augment whatever the scant health data are with other kinds of data that you can bring to those records and do in a validated way. The other way that we've done, which is not around COVID, but it speaks to what is necessary for COVID, is that what we've watched in COVID, for me, is very strikingly similar to what happened with the surge in data as well as research around police violence starting in 2014 in this country. So basically, and I was involved in that and still am, where there are no good official data. I mean, we've done the work led by one of my students, Justin Feldman, now a colleague, to demonstrate, again, that the U.S. vital statistics grossly undercounts by 50% the number of people killed by the police each year. There's a whole separate question, why are the vital statistics so lousy? That's a different conversation for another time. But what happened is that The Guardian and others began to crowdsource. They began to able to use the new technologies. Investigative journalists have been an absolutely phenomenal asset here. And they set up the system that counted. And even the FBI director back then was chagrined to acknowledge that a UK newspaper had set up the best data set reporting system on police killings in the United States. And then the Obama administration, right before in its final days of office, had begun to implement a protocol program, pilot program within the Department of Justice that replicated this kind of methodology of using the kinds of sourcing that the Guardian and the Counted and Fatal Encounters and other websites use, tracking systems, with the existing data. And that, of course, got the kibosh put on it when the Trump administration came in. Similarly, with COVID, what's been fascinating to see, it's been the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, major journalisms have been doing and filling in the work that underfunded, overworked, and potentially censored health departments have been unable to do. So there's a part, and they're relying in part on what health departments are reporting, but they're also trying to access records in all other kinds of ways. So I think that even with the extent to which data are decentralized in the public health data in the United States, so states report to CDC. I mean, CDC does some of its own surveys that it actually leads and holds, but a lot of the state data come to the CDC from the state. So you have to deal with what all the state apparatus are, and within that, the local within the state. So I don't think the data will ever all go away. I think it may be harder to get at it, but there's going to be ways to keep finding it, even if the CDC is not allowed to publish certain data. But the dramatic response, which is that people need this data, it's in the frame of preparedness. If you don't know the data, whether you're a Republican governor, a Democrat governor, or an independent governor, if your people in your states are dying and your hospitals are crashing out, that's not a good thing.
So this question,
ignorance about that isn't going to help.
This builds on that. It's a question from online from Olivia. Our county, I'm not sure which county, an executive is using the fact that 40% of the county's cases are missing racial and ethnic data as a reason for not presenting the numbers of cases and case rates by race and ethnicity on the county's data dashboard, just the number of deaths and death rates. And so it's not specific for age or age adjusted. What suggestions do you have on how to combat that perspective?
So first, to be very clear, for the death data, there are no excuse to have missing racial ethnic data because that is a standard component of the death certificate. And what is being apparent over time is that it went even at the national level from like a horrifying 40-odd% missing, even more, to now like fewer than just a few percent are missing data for deaths on the death certificate. So that there should be no excuse from having those data missing on the deaths. For the cases, what you can do is you can A, note what's missing. B, what you can do is you can still say something about where that you know, they know where the cases are happening. They can say something about the demographics of the populations from which the cases arise. And the other thing that I think is really important on these dashboards is that for some reason with COVID-19, more so than any other outcome, people are getting fixated on the number of cases as opposed to remembering that it's important to calculate rates. Because the number of cases depend on the size of the population and also the time intervals that are in which those cases arise. And so I think that it's really important to be, you can do the simplistic approach of saying what proportion of cases are X race ethnicity compared to the general population. That tells you something, but it doesn't tell you enough. And so I think you have to be honest if you're really missing all those data. You have to be honest about why. And also have something on the dashboard that says what you're doing to try to change that. But the answer is not to suppress it. Because the other thing to say is that you can do a sensitivity analysis in effect and say, well, if what would be the extremes of distribution if everyone that was missing belonged to this group or that group or this distribution or that distribution? It's not unknown. There's something.
Since you started publishing some of your studies, this question's from online, have you seen more places collect the kind of data that you need to ask these really important questions around COVID-19, race, and poverty?
So, I mean, I think that there has been real movement on some of the different local and state dashboards that I've seen. Just to give but one example, I mean, just even on the simple thing of comparing the proportion of cases, what their racial ethnic composition is, for example, to that of the population as a whole. There are some like Seattle King County, which has long had an equity perspective built into their public health approach. You can see that clearly presented on their dashboard for the state and for the county. They also do a very interesting thing, which is that they allow you to easily include or subtract the nursing home population. And what happens when you do that, which is interesting to see, is that if you look just at cases overall, it might look like a white excess for the mortality. But if you actually subtract out the nursing home, you see that much higher risk of mortality among Latinx, which speaks very much to the workplace. Because what you're doing is you're restricting to more the working age adults. So I think giving that kind of flexibility to understand the different populations at risk. I mean, clearly in Massachusetts, the nursing home populations were a key, very vulnerable community, but that's not the same as what's happening in Chelsea or in Lawrence or in Mattapan.
One question, another from online that maybe follows up a little bit with this is, the Trump administration's immigration policies have pushed many immigrants into the shadows. Do your data look at links between COVID-19 and immigration status? Is there a way to do that?
In the data that I've been analyzing, which are strictly these case and death data thus far, no, those data are not there. However, I'm very aware that there is work, there are qualitative as well as quantitative studies underway looking at what's going on with COVID among undocumented people, both in relation to risk and in relation to reporting of data and in relation to mortality. And so that, again, gets back to your earlier question of there's more, in a sense, almost citizen science trying to find that out or make the links available to people. And so I, with another organization, we have a COVID-19 and health justice resource guide. And one whole tab of that is about people who are immigrants and undocumented, for example. And that's important because that's coming from people on the ground. And it may wend its way eventually into scientific literature, but this is happening in real time. So it's not in the data that I personally am analyzing right now, but it's incredibly important. And there are people doing that. And there are surveys underway specifically that I've seen for undocumented people about what's going on with their risks around exposure to COVID. And remember, it all starts with exposure. And if people are not exposed, they don't get sick.
So we just have about a minute or two left. So I want to ask this one final question from online that I think kind of connects some of the threads you've been talking about to then wrap up, which is about a social justice question, which I think speaks to a lot of the threads in the research and work that you've done pre-COVID, but also now. The pandemic's shown a light on social justice issues that impact, in particular, communities of color. And so when you think about what are the connections here, and I want to add on to that, like, how do you see this conversation moving forward, given where we're at, where the conversations are in this country right now, in this moment? So again, it's sort of like a concluding kind of wrap up of where you see these connections, but also how you see moving these sorts of conversations and policies forward.
So I think that this, we're in a moment where you can say in a sense that, I mean, there are endless crises, but particularly between COVID-19, the climate crisis, and with that, all the environmental racism and climate injustice that's built in, and also the police violence with a lens towards structural racism, which always includes the economic impacts of that. It's not just about only people's feelings towards each other. There's major economic repercussions and also reasons why the structural racism persists as such. What has come together is saying, let's link these things up in policy proposals as is being articulated. For example, if you look at the websites, whether you look at Sunrise around climate justice, or you look at Black Lives Matters, or you look at the Poor People's Campaign, the interweaving of people understanding the connections between these all these issues that are necessary to have a society in which people can live healthy lives that are dignified and thrive. And I think this is giving a platform for expressing what is that going to look like and who needs to be allies working together to make those kinds of changes. And I see that happening in ways that I find heartening. In the midst of everything else going on, those are important connections that people are making that are becoming as integrative as our bodies are every day, integrating what our experiences are, and then using that to change how we want the world to be.
That was Nancy Krieger, professor of social epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this discussion on our Facebook pages, at Forum HSPH and at PRI The World, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. You can join us again on August 11th, when we'll be talking with Jocelyn Kelly of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative about the pandemic's impact on vulnerable communities across the globe. Thanks for listening.
From PRX.